So that's all right then, Liz. The 45 pence rate of tax for top earners will stay, and begorra, with one bound she was freed. Not. What we speculate on where this week will leave Liz Truss after her speech to the party faithful on Wednesday, and look at Kwasi Kwarteng's efforts to try and retrieve the situation. Can the Tory MPs actually vote through the finance bill that their leading big beasts have described as unconservative with its unfunded borrowing? Can they vote for that finance bill when it finally comes before them to enact the bits of legislation that Liz Truss manages to get through and not U-turn upon? Because if they can't, there will be a new leader and potentially a general election coming. We discuss. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast, which is going out on a Tuesday as per normal, because there is no need, we believe, to wait for that short, sharp shock of Liz Truss's speech to the Tory party conference tomorrow. I think we've all heard quite enough to make our own evaluation of the actual shambles, and I had to stop myself from saying something else that began with SH, that they've managed to make of everything that they've done in the few days that they have actually been the new. It all starts here. Everything we've done in the last 10 years has been rubbish government.
It is quite gobsmacking. And you have to keep, you know, there's a thing there where, I mean, I'm sure that a lot of folk watching this are just thinking these guys are getting their just desserts. It's great to see them being pounded by the markets. You know, I mean, their best pals, that the only thing that ever matters to them, the folk who can predict how to make money, you know, Kwarteng getting basically summoned back from a swally with millionaires who made yep. money from his crashing, tanking the pound, them criticising the BBC, BBC Scotland even, for saying tanking the pound at long last, the BBC calling it like it is. I mean, even The Times with a fabulous headline, Scottish Tories welcome U-turn on tax cut they supported, which yeah. you can't put it. So Douglas Ross having to answer questions about whether or not, you know, his leadership is in turmoil. But all the time, there's such real impacts on that, you know, on people with all sorts of problems with mortgages. You're so speechless with the crisis they've already caused. And actually, there's been calculations done on the impact that, even though the markets have steadied a little bit, the impact there's been on the average person with a mortgage of about £200,000, which I don't think is even the average actual mortgage in the UK, is now paying £1,000 a year more because of Kwasi Kwarteng. So, you know, people have done the maths, and that's, they haven't, you know, and the astonishing thing is they could have always done the maths. You know what I mean? Yes. There's plenty of things in the past where they could have just gone, nah. But actually, it's significant that they're now deciding, because I think they sent weakness. They sent blood. You know, they realize these guys are just hopeless. And actually, I don't know if you saw this, but there's the most extraordinary editorial opinion column in the Telegraph, in the FT, sorry, on Sunday, which is just, I don't know if you saw this online, but it's, forgive me for just quoting a wee bit out of it, because it's jaw-dropping. It basically is saying Liz Truss has been weighed in the balance and found wanting, so too has Kwasi Kwarteng. A week of unnecessary and damaging turmoil has proved this, but behind it is a bigger danger. The only sort of leader more dangerous than the rogue the UK used to have is the zealot it has yes. now.
Yeah.
And it goes on to sort of talk about many, many things. Really, I do suggest you have a look, because it's actually going around online with, you can actually get unusually through to the FT and actually read the whole thing. But what it also says, and this is more to the point of, you know, what they could easily have said before now, it says first, you know, these kind of magic potions for growth, the thing about bankers' bonuses, the lower taxes for the prosperous, saying abracadabra, and suddenly trend productivity growth quadruples. Such dreams might be amusing if they were not so perilous. And then he says, first, it comes on a long line of fibs that justified excess fiscal austerity yes. after the financial crisis, fibs that Brexit would bring prosperity, fibs that the Northern Ireland protocol had solved the Brexit conundrum. All of this, right? And just the final line, because I sense people will just have a, you know, this is so much and no more. It says at the end, Truss and Quartang will not deliver growth. Unfunded tax cuts and investment zones will not deliver this. Another big jump in inequality will not deliver us. These people are mad, bad and dangerous. They have to go.
Yeah.
That's the FT, folks.
Yeah, well, I have actually found the FT over the past few years has actually been a bastion of sense in lots of its writing and the analysis that is done, for example, over inequality, etc. The FT, because they actually believe in facts, you know, and as the old
but phrase. But still, the point I'm trying to make is, well, several ones. One is if you've got that long list of fibs that relate to the last administration, you know, and you're talking about, you know, basically Boris Johnson as the rogue the UK used to have. Yeah. And fair enough, I hear what you're saying. They, you know, they weren't pulling their punches all the time before now. But this is coming out with all guns blazing now from the FT. And this is not, they're not alone. I mean, the Daily Mail, God forced myself to look at the at some of the headlines on that, basically telling the PM today to get a grip and accuses her of having buckled at the first sign of trouble in a deeply humiliating U-turn. I mean, that's the one about deciding that the 45 pence tax rate will not be abolished. So basically, you know, it's extraordinary. Again, somebody telling the FT, an anonymous Truss-backing MP says, if she can't get a 2 billion tax cut through, I can't see how she's got a hope in hell of planning reform or anything else. Liz wanted to be radical, but she's failed at the first hurdle. And just one more that was to the organisation Politico. People aren't mysteriously really shit and then become really good.
Yeah.
One senior Tory MP says.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, what frustrates me, though, Leslie, is the fact that it goes back to this, that she punted right throughout her campaign to become leader of the Conservative Party, the theory of trickle-down economics. And as we've said before, this has been blown out the water. I mean, that's what George Bush referred to as the voodoo economics, has been blown out the water over decades. And the BBC put something up before Kwasi Kwarteng made his U-turn on the 45p cut, the cut to that rate. I said, have you got any questions that you'd like us to put to Kwasi Kwarteng? And I simply sent in, can you give one example where your theories have actually worked? Because they haven't. And the IMF, as I've said before, just like the FT, not exactly a bastion of progressive radical socialism, said, if the income share for the top 20% goes up, GDP goes down. If it goes up for the bottom 20%, GDP goes up. And every single reputable economist has turned around and said that what the UK needs to do is increase its productivity. And you do that by investing in people and reskilling. You do that by proper infrastructure projects. You don't do it by investment zones. And you very definitely, according to every reputable economist going, do it by trickle down economics and cutting the rates. Even at the claim is that they're not cutting the rate of for corporation tax. They're merely keeping it at the previous rate before, because they say that keeping it at that rate is really, really good at getting inward investment. Well, this is a really odd one, because since the Conservatives came into power, we have 19% corporation tax, and that doesn't seem to have worked in increasing our GDP, and it definitely hasn't worked in increasing productivity. So it is actually voodoo economics, and the FT is absolutely spot on, and eventually the real questions are being asked that do move away from the politics to it, to the actual economics of it. And Nick Robinson went on about that this morning. He said it's back to what Bill Clinton said. It's the economy, stupid.
Indeed. Just on what you were saying there, though, also, I was listening to Good Morning Scotland. Very good interview by Martin Geisler.
Absolutely.
With Lord Malcolm Offord, who is the unelected Tory donor, who is the unparliamentary undersecretary of state, the Scotland office. You might remember a row about him getting that job despite, you know, absolutely no involvement formally in any form of politics in an elected capacity. But anyway, but what he kept stressing was that the people, because he was constantly asked about what will now be the next big thing, which is as I mentioned in the Herald column that I wrote, which was predicting that there will be an election, actually, but that's perhaps one to unravel. The next thing will be benefits, whether they're going to be raised in line with inflation or with wages. And quite obviously, if you listen to Truss and, you know, both of them basically over the weekend, but her particularly, when she was interviewed by Laura Kunzberg on Sunday, Truss made an absolute commitment to maintain the triple lock on pensions, which basically means that pensions raised by inflation or wages, whichever is the higher. So essentially, they're protected against high inflation. She was then asked about benefits and didn't make the same commitment. So, you know, now when they're all on, and indeed she was, that point was put to her by Nick Robinson on the Today programme this morning, he was just contrasting that ability to make that commitment to pensioners because they vote Tory, fundamentally, not all pensioners. I mean, I know we've got a lot of pensioners listening to this, but, you know, there's more of a tendency for pensioners to vote Tory. There's certainly more of a tendency for claimants not to vote Tory. So, you know, you just look at that and figure out what you will from it. But the thing that was interesting about this Malcolm Offord interview on GMS was that when he was had that put to him and said, how can you possibly justify not, you know, I mean, this ludicrous thing of basically saying you're going to help the poorest people and then essentially take thousands of quid out of their pockets by not index linking their benefits. He was saying the important thing is that there's really talented people out there on benefits and we need to help them get back into work and we need to incentivize them to upgrade from low wage to higher wage jobs. Right. This blows your brains with the number of questions that could come straight in on the back of it. Like, just as a matter of interest, who does the lower paid jobs then? How do higher wage jobs suddenly sort of manifest in a situation where nobody will want to make any sorts of investments because you've basically tanked the economy? But just apart from everything else, what does that mean? You know, are they going to incentivize people to upgrade? You know what, Tory? It's that horrible chilled feeling you get when you hear normally positive words spoken by Tories. You have to sort of think, what do they actually mean here in terms of marching people off benefits in some way? I don't know what they're up to, but this clearly is the last bit of the mantra that they're hanging on to is that they're going to get people back into work. And he repeated twice in that interview that 1% growth equals £47 billion into the Treasury. So growth not to be sniffed at. I mean, Martin Geisler, to be fair to him, actually put to him twice that this growth would take years to materialise, you know, even if it did actually. And in the meantime, they've squandered more than £47 billion with the money, our money, that needed to go in to stabilise the economy after their crap mini budget that they didn't even wait for their own Tory creation, the Office of Budget Responsibility, to correct. So, I mean, it's just it is hopeless. And I can't see how they're going to manage to stabilize themselves, because that attempt today by Liz Truss to trot round the different airwaves and sort of like, you know, charm the hell out of everybody. I mean, we haven't had time to look at the kind of reaction to that. But I mean, dearie me, you know, it absolutely didn't work. And if anyone was listening yesterday, I know this sounds like a summary of the Blinken Today programme, but they are the ones that these guys trot out for. And basically, Nick Robinson took the legs off Kwasi Kwarteng. It was, I mean, I have to say, a masterclass of interviewing. And I know what Nick Robinson's politics are. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that hell hath no fury like a Tory scorned. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Tories that are actually furious with what Kwarteng and Truss are doing, because they're wrecking the Tory party. They're making them unelectable. And when these guys get angry, it is almost amusing to sit back and listen until you remind yourself of the chaos they're causing everywhere, which, again, to give credit to Catherine Sampson, the excellent political editor of STV, she started a very short interview she had last night with Liz Truss saying, do you enjoy chaos? And Truss, I mean, although she's, you know, pretty imperturbable, she did kind of slightly move butt cheeks, you know, in the chair for a second, you know, and kind of said, I don't know what you mean, you know, and she continued. I mean, it's a great tradition that that Colin Mackay and Catherine Sampson have now developed for STV, is that they go in with both feet up and running to all these interviews. They're not worshipful. They're not cutting or, you know, messing about. And I'm sorry, BBC Scotland, apart from Martin Geisler, you know, everybody else that's going in is just, you know, they're really not tough enough.
Well, I mean, I Nick Robinson, the interview with Liz Truss went out today. It was recorded yesterday lunchtime. And I'm paraphrasing what he said, but what he said to her was, Liz Truss, can you say now that what you say today won't have changed by the time this interview goes out? And it is that kind of situation. But again, it was a terrific interview you gave with Liz Truss today. But I'm going to say to this, that praising Catherine Sampson. But I don't know about you. I saw Paul Mason, you know, that bastion of the left, an intellectual and writer and progressive, he would consider himself to be, absolutely slaughtering the fact that Liz Truss's initial set of interviews were going to be done by BBC local journalists. And he disparaged them with an illustration of Alan Partridge and claimed it this was Liz Truss dodging things. And rather than going in front of the heavy hitters, she was going to go to these semi-awake young people who knew nothing in these local radio stations. Paul Mason was entirely wrong, because they gave her a shooing, and they were absolutely superb. I mean, the BBC, and people haven't listened to it as well, we're delving into, which is the BBC put a compilation together in a podcast of what these local radio interviewers did. They went in unashamed, thinking to themselves, well, I'm not having to mingle with the politicals, you know, I'm here, I'm in Radio Norfolk or wherever. I'm not having to be someone who hangs about the lobbies looking for little snippets and tidbits of information. Oh, tell me this. Oh, thank you, I got an exclusive on that. No, they went in there and they actually they rubbished her. And it was the first time I've actually heard that done on a consistent basis by the BBC. And it was the heads up to the local radio presenters. They were absolutely excellent.
Totally. Absolutely. I'm astonished that Paul Mason was that patronising. But you go. The left can make some bad mistakes. But still no more than, you know, still than Kwasi Kwarteng. I mean, it's still jaw dropping, actually. The kind of, you know, that speech that he did, which is, it's interesting that we've got this far into it and we haven't talked about his own, you know, the speech that supposedly everyone was waiting for. But I mean, the you know, he did a 20 minute speech sort of acknowledging it had been a tough day. Right. Tough day. Mm. When everyone was expecting some reassurance for everyone who's had their mortgage deals withdrawn. He dismissed the market chaos as a little turbulence. Mm-hmm. And okay, maybe, you know, he thinks he's got a little bit of style there, and that was a little bit of kind of tee-hee stuff for, you know, the Tory, those Tory MPs who've turned up to be in the room, which apparently is about half of them. So half of them have stayed away, and people were just absolutely scathing. I mean, again, politicals have got reports of, you know, just people texting, and this is another thing, how open people are being about their contempt for these two journalists who are going to turn it round, you know. You know, one MP texted, was that it? Another person said they were expecting more. People saying things are well past crisis mode. And actually, just on your point about the FT, they had the Today programme had Baroness Camilla Cavendish. I mean, honestly, why does anybody do this to themselves? You know, I'm not trying to be funny, but if you're called Camilla Cavendish, all you need is to become a baroness to have the tin lid properly applied. But no, Camilla has decided to become Baroness Cavendish of Little Venice. Right, just going to stop there. But anyway, she was a director of policy for David Cameron. So she's saying, basically, she said quite openly about this government, power is draining away. And ministers I've spoken to, that's current ministers, don't expect to be there for more than a few months.
Right. That's
so, you know, so this does bring you then onto kind of what exactly is kind of going to happen in all of this, because, you know, they can stumble on. Let's look at what happened politically when Michael Gove, my God, you know, the idea that Michael Gove should be any sort of, you know, speaker of some kind of inconvenient partial truths. But you know, his thing is, as he made very clear on the airwaves on Sunday, which prompted the U-turn, which apparently was prompted by Graham Brady, who is the chair of the 1922 committee, going in on Sunday night to Liz Truss, saying that she had to change the 45 pence thing, that there was sufficient, you know, disquiet in the Tory ranks for that to have to stop. So basically, she got ordered essentially to turn that one around already. But the bigger picture that Gove and then Grant Shapps got onto, and again, I can't believe we're even, you know, yes. Is that it's unconservative to have unfunded borrowing. Now, whatever they do, fiddling around with not doing this, not doing that, you know, and their difficulty then, if they actually do inflation link benefits, is that that adds to, I can't quite remember the sum, but it's around 40 billion of unfunded underfunded cuts and spending. So they've got a big problem there already with their own ranks, which is just, this is unconservative. So when once you've labelled your own people, have labelled your core approach to stuff unconservative, you've got a really big problem then, because it's not obvious where, you know, where any of this can come from other than massive austerity, which is also being predicted by those in the know, like Stephanie Flanders. Or, you know what, more borrowing, which just, again, spooks even the markets because it's so unsustainable. For what, as Keir Starmer, you know, actually put for just what? Making rich people richer. Now, OK, they've managed to perhaps lose some of the edge on that with 45 pence. But the wheels are coming off this cart really, really quickly. And the Tories know they're going to lose the next election extraordinarily. No, you know, at the moment, that's what the prediction is. So I just wonder how they're going to get the finance bill through the Commons. Because none of any of this stuff becomes actually active until they get a finance bill relating to that, not a budget, through the Commons. And as things stand, I mean, already I see that they've suggested that that finance bill has been pushed along a little bit, you know, giving them some time to kind of, you know, retrieve support from their own ranks. And equally, they're going to publish, it's ludicrous, the report that will land on their desks from the Office of Budget Responsibility was going to be published in 5 weeks' time on this 23rd of November. I don't know what that date ever did in life to deserve being lumped with, you know, the level of significance it was about to have, still will have, because that's when the rest of the hoo-hoo package gets unveiled. But still, the Office of Budget Responsibility's verdict will be out by the end of October. So, I mean, do they get this finance bill through? You know, is this a point where, with all the rumours that there are in the background, that people are already unbelievably talking about trying to get Boris back? Can you believe this?
Oh, I can.
Or drafting Rishi Sunak? Well, you know, that's the stuff doing the rounds in the background, that these are the solutions to go back to. Right. Now, just even if you take Scotland out of it, does anyone really think that the rest of the UK is ready for another drafted in unelected change of leadership within the Tory party, when even their own supporters are saying that it's time, even freaking mad nads, basically Nadine Dorris, I can't believe we've even mentioned her in a podcast in a non-derisory way. She's got her own reasons for wanting a general election soon, which is how very dare Liz Truss dump her masterpiece, which was privatisation of Channel 4, that was all ready to go. And now apparently Liz has said that's not such priority because, hey, we've got our hands full. So Mad Nads now wants to have a general election because of that. But still, you know, that will gather a little bit of, you know, steam. So I don't know, you know, look at what happened just last weekend. Even if it wasn't reported, you know, there were enough is enough demonstrations in six cities, including Glasgow. There was an all under one banner demonstration in Edinburgh. There was Extinction Rebellion protests throughout London, which closed all the central bridges, including Westminster Bridge. There was a rally in Ireland about reunification. I think there was something in Wales that I may have missed. Yes. And there was a rail strike, and there are ballots for more strikes. I mean, you know, this is not the docile, we'll just roll over set of people, especially in England, that may have accompanied previous changes of Tory leadership. And the idea that everyone goes, oh, well, you're a bit, you're a bit rubbish, I. Let's just get Boris back. I mean, they're still investigating him. He hasn't managed to torpedo the Commons Committee that's looking into whether he deliberately misled the Commons, unfortunately for him. So, yeah, he's still under investigation. We know he lied. He's essentially said he lied. He's discredited. He was the one that, had brought this unproductive, non-growth-oriented economy to its knees, such that Liz Truss needed to revive it with all these madcap ideas. Yeah, let's have him back. Or let's have Rishi Sunak. He was beaten.
Yeah. Oh, no, Rishi Sunak's not daft. He's not the next leader of the Conservative Party. He's the next leader of the Conservative Party, if he's got any sense. And that's.
But
the,
here we are now. Yeah. What will happen now? What I'm asking is, does anybody see a scenario where if they can't get that finance, if they pass her finance bill, the Tories pass her finance bill, they're locked and loaded and wedded to her.
Yes.
They have approved her. They have approved all the nonsense and then nothing adding up stuff that will come in the next month. Potentially, the OBR thing will be extremely grim reading and they'll ignore it. So they're approving all of that. That's what it means to vote for this. And, you know, astonishingly, at the very point that Michael Gove was on TV talking about the unconservative nature of these, you know, this unfunded platform, the warning was going out that if anybody doesn't vote for this bill, they will lose the Tory whip. Tory chairman Jake Berry was on ITV, right in the other channel at the very same time, saying that anyone who didn't vote for the finance bill would lose the party whip, as in you ain't no Tory no more. Now, minutes after that, when you actually looked at the timeline, there was a tweet by Julian Smith. I know who he, but he was indeed a Tory cabinet minister for a year, even Northern Ireland secretary. But just straight after that, he tweeted, "The first job of an MP is to act in the interests of constituents and the national interest. We cannot clap for carers 1 month and cut tax for millionaires months later." So, I mean, OK, that's part of what made them drop that 45 pence thing. But I wouldn't have thought Julian Smith looks like he's, you know, totally on board. And even just minutes after that, the Sunday show on BBC Scotland had Andrew Bowie on, the Tory MP. And he, although he started off looking cheery chappy and kind of it's all fine and everything, again, Martin Geiser doing the questioning, had to agree with Michael Gove that unfunded borrowing was not conservative. So I can't see how they're doing anything other than heading for a total car crash where the Tories either have to back something that will not work or decide not to back it, in which case we've already heard they'll lose the party whip. Now, what happens then?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, and just a whole lot of them, though, Leslie, will say and do anything in order to actually toe the party line. I mean, Douglas Ross is the perfect example of this, you know, where this is a great set of tax cuts. Why isn't Scotland following through it? And then, oh, no, I totally support Kwasi Kwarteng in reversing this cut, which, by the way, wasn't a major policy. Oh, no. This wasn't a central plank in the theory of trickle-down economics, which is reward the people at the top, and that's going to increase productivity. No, this was all about optics. So you've got that going on. But you've hit the nail on the head, though, that Truss was elected by the party, which has moved far, far to the right. And again, the FT has been absolutely excellent on this, in this graph that they drew up of the spectrum of the left and right. And the UK Conservative Party is now out beyond Fratelli d'Italia and the Sweden Democrats in terms of its reactionary position. They supported it, but she does not have the support and did not have the support of her MPs, who are savvy enough to know, particularly those who were elected in red wall constituencies, that this was going to go down like a lead balloon. And trying to spin it that was optics, it's only £2 billion. People have a fine sense of fairness. They saw that this was money being given to those who have, and they could see what was coming down the line, that money was going to be taken away from those who do not have. And it's in the scale of cuts. The money that's going to be saved in corporation tax is going to be virtually equivalent in terms of its 18-point-odd billion in 1 year to the money that they're going to have to cut to actually balance the books to stave off after the intervention of the Bank of England now goes out of, you know, it passes its time date, to stave off yet another run on the pound and yet another potential run on UK long-term bonds. That is the gilt on which our pension funds depend to pay our pensions in the future. They're absolutely, I cannot see any way out of it for them. I really cannot. And they must.
So the question is
that.
Then, what happens next? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, of course, everyone's saying, no. I mean, you hear them, that Malcolm Offord today was talking about, we've got 2 years to turn this round. So they're all thinking, yeah, we're definitely going for a general election as long away as we possibly can. But I still can't see quite how they get over even the finance bill. And, you know, the Tories are ruthless when they think they've got a loser that, you know, they get rid of them. So it's very, very possible when they get rid of them, I don't think that the Britain, rarely even use that expression in this podcast because it so rarely encompasses anything that we find very meaningful. But in this instance, actually, I don't think Britain will stand for another unelected change of leader who also deviates from the platform of the, you know, manifesto upon which the previous lot were elected. And that's not just true of Truss going way off beam with 2019, but Boris going way off beam with what Theresa May was elected on. So we're way, way, way off the script now. And I mean, either, well, England can decide what it wants to do, but, you know, enough is enough is a good solid set of, you know, a spine of organisation for the Labour movement. And obviously, while we're at it, Labour is doing extremely well in the polls. Oh, so just you know, there's it's not, even if Keir Starmer is sitting there thinking, yeah, let's just let it play out. Let them put Boris back in again. Let them put some weakling in who will just, you know, really be the tin lid. And let's just have our 2 year kind of prognosis up to a 2024 general election. And yeah, all the stuff that happens in the meantime, well, it'll just really seal the deal for us. I don't think that's even viable, you know, and the same for the SNP. If the SNP think, yeah, we've got our schedule for putting our papers out and, you know, we want to have a bit of time to kind of get this into a kind of a de facto independence referendum and that, you know, we need to sort of shuffle it all around. I think there could be a general election any time, you know, really. And that we should be conscious of that and aware that we need to be active. To which end? Yes. You know, you've got Liz Truss coming out yesterday and saying that even if the Supreme Court basically says that the Scottish government is completely within its rights to be able to put forward an advisory referendum on independence, that she will not abide by the results. Which is astonishing, you know. But as people will know, I've been very much suggesting that we need to be ready to be active and seen and impactful as a yes movement from here on in. And the first moment that will probably happen will be the verdict handed down by the Supreme Court. Now, when that happens, I've suggested that we need to get out to Holyrood because the cameras will be there that day. Can't say 100%, but, you know, pretty much on news values, unless, of course, Liz Truss has accidentally blown up the UK, which you can't rule out. There will be attention paid to that. Absolutely, there will. So when the cameras are there, we have to be there because otherwise it looks like we don't give a toss. There's a lot of response to that. And kind of just to say to people, it's quite hard for me to handle as one person with no backup whatsoever. It's quite hard to handle all the individual emails, Twitter messages, stuff coming in at the moment. There's a wee posse of us getting organised and we hope to have a website out before the end of the week, which will let individuals go on, register to be sent an alert when we know that this announcement, the verdict is 24 to 48 hours away. And when we know which day we're going for that event. So it would be great if people could, when we're ready to launch that, and we'll have that out in the National and every other sort of avenue that we can, it would be great if people could individually go in and sign up on that one. And if you're in groups, yes groups or whatever, have conversations in the groups. I've tried to speak to as many groups as I can, spoke to the National Yes Networks at the weekend, spoke to Yes Edinburgh Lothians, lots of enthusiasm there and great ideas and tangible support, including a bloody wooden platform. I suddenly woke up in the middle of the night thinking, wooden platform. So we've got all sorts of really helpful stuff coming in. What we need at the moment is just for people to just call Canny, but just get ready to actually do something on this front. And then consider that when that's done, we have to probably do something else. You know, it's not like you can sink back into your chair relieved when we've done this one, because this is now, you know, actions that will continue until we've got the question resolved of the referendum that we care about. Who knows what the SNP might or might not do. That's if they decide to crank themselves up, that's fine. Although actually, I think this event will be stronger for the fact that it is a bunch of individual punters turning up, not an SNP organized event. Although, you know, it would be always would be nice if there was support, but we don't need that. We're just getting going and doing this ourselves. So that's going to be happening over the next week. Just people kind of keep your eyes out. I mean, some of the things that people have raised in some of these meetings, they're worried about events being taken over by BAMS, not mention any names, mm-hmm. but people, we can't stop campaigns because we're worried about a couple of BAMS, and we will have stewards, you know, but actually people need to be assertive if they think something's happening beside them, not aggressive, but just calmly assertive to just stop stuff that looks like it's difficult. But we can't stop. And actually, in the, you know, 5 o'clock with 3,000 people, hopefully outside Holyrood, I'm not sure that anybody is going to manage to make too much of a disruptive effort to that. So let's just put that in context. That's not a reason to hesitate about doing something that will be well organised. Could there be a third way with the Supreme Court verdict? Yes, there could. I may get the legal terminology of this wrong, in which case, please forgive me, all the legal people who understand it better. But essentially, the court could decide that because it didn't get a referendum bill put before it, that it's not really able to come to a conclusion mm-hmm. about what the Scottish government does or doesn't have the power to do. In a sense, you know, a score draw, you know, it's not clear. But I mean, the thinking from the groups I've spoken to is we still turn out because it's still a story. And essentially what that adds up to is now is still not the time, you know, whereas we are saying it's up to the Scottish people to decide when the time is. So the deal is that when Scotland and its constitutional future is in the news anyway, we have to be there as if we give a toss and defining what we consider the narrative to be. Because there's no point complaining about, you know, the BBC or other people, you know, essentially deciding the narrative of something when we haven't got ourselves organised in advance as much as we can for something that is utterly predictably going to happen, which is the Supreme, you know, it's like being Supreme Court's pregnant, it's going to have a baby, you know, okay, it may be a boy, it may be a girl, there may be health problems, but something will happen. So we have to be ready for that. And if we can't organise for this, what are we about? So,
Yeah, well, absolutely. So keep your eyes open for the website going up, folks. I was just intrigued. Back to the Liz Truss statement about, even though the Supreme Court may come out and turn around and say that the Scottish government, Scottish Parliament, is perfectly entitled to call a referendum on Scottish independence, we say no. I've yet to spot any reaction from Labour, the Liberal Democrats, you know, on this. Or am I being willfully ignorant, Leslie? Have any of them actually said anything about this lack of democracy and this flouting of what would be a legal decision, saying it was within the purview of the Scottish Parliament to actually call an independence referendum?
I don't think so. I mean, of course, likely. I mean, we've all been. I've not been searching for that as much as you know, all the chaos. But no, haven't seen in the articles that covered that in the Herald and the National. There was no comments from the opposition. So yeah, it looks like that's all perfectly okay.
Yeah, that silence speaks, again, that silence speaks absolute volumes. We have that lead for Labour. Interesting one. I don't know if you noted that the shadow cabinet has, or shadow minister, sorry, not the shadow cabinet, has turned around and said that the reform of the House of Lords, and this will come as no surprise to anyone, will not take place in the first term of any Labour government, but that is for consideration in any Labour government's second term. So there you go. We thought that big reform of the House of Lords into a Senate of the Regions and Nations was going to take place when Labour got in. Nope, that's going to be a second term one. And there've been significant questions raised about the paucity of ambition. I mean, and far be it from me to criticise the Labour Party on paucity of ambition for a national energy company. But Labour List, for example, has come out with a scathing analysis of the lack of ambition in that great British energy company, which is not going to be a nationalised energy company as in defined about owning the generation and owning the distribution of energy as suggested by the TUC, which could actually, if it was run on the French lines, could make billions each year, which would feed back into the Treasury to be able to be spent in the UK economy. But it's simply another mechanism which leaves in place entirely the privatised system set up by Margaret Thatcher. So it's worthwhile having a look at that. It's very technical about the way the markets actually work. But know what's going to happen is that it's going to be something that's going to exist within the existing framework and is not going to bring down the profits that are still going to go back to these generation and distribution companies, which are absolutely massive. So again, it's very, very disappointing. And it doesn't match up to the pledges that were made in the 2019 manifesto under Jeremy Corbyn. But again, Labour looks likely, and just before anybody says anything, would I prefer a Labour government in the UK if one had to live within the UK to the current Conservatives? You bet your bottom dollar I would. But I'm eternally disappointed as I am with reformists who do not actually go the whole mile to actually tackle the root causes of why we're in the situation to do with the energy crisis. And it is to do with the lack of investment in renewables and restructuring the market so it's actually a nationalised energy system that we have and not one that is subject to the vagaries of the market and obscene profits being made.
Yeah, and if you want to see something that's free-ish to read, then actually I wrote about all of this in last week's National. Just after I listened to the Keir Starmer speech at his conference, and yeah, absolutely, so many things. But you'd have to say actually this was still the kind of public sector energy company that the SNP had pledged. It was going to be an additional player in a basically broken market. So that, of course, I suppose the SNP could say is within the context of a UK run energy policy. So they're in the same way as they have to make things the best, you know, the best they can out of systems that they wouldn't actually have in an independent country. That could be their reasoning, but we're yet to hear any enthusiasm from anybody about how they would deal with, you know, whether or not we just cruise ahead in independence with the six, you know, the big six or whoever's left at the end of the collapse that the Tories will have inflicted on everything by the time we get there. Yeah. But sure, you know, what passes for radical these days, I mean, just as you said last week with reference to the parallels with, you know, the Italian right and the sort of Sweden Democrats and so on, everything has shifted so much to the right, including, you know, the level of which BBC commentary is now just an internal sort of Tory discussion zone. Absolutely. And whilst that is quite entertaining, as per earlier quotes, when they actually get a bit frisky, it still normalizes Tory thinking, you know, so that you begin to get to that nice Michael Gove kind of line, or the, you know, people saying bring back Boris Johnson, or they get away with, well, there was lots of good things in the budget apart from, you know, the 45 pence thing. And nobody challenges that because, you know, we've shifted so far to the right that all they're looking for are little kind of bits of dissent on the utterly ludicrous stuff they're coming up with, as opposed to the whole platform. And I don't know how the BBC, I've said this before, but, you know, 4,000 years ago when I worked there, you know, we could not have got away with the prolonged exposure of Tories talking amongst themselves as balanced journalism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whilst that they could have had a semi kind of argument during the Tory leadership contest, which also was going to produce a UK prime minister, although there's many people, you know, who would think that's a very ropey kind of situation anyway. That's over now. So, you know, you can't. Why is, for example, Fraser Nelson is never off our screens, you know, as the editor of The Spectator. And it's a constant plug for that magazine. I mean, I don't know, does The New Statesman have an editor anymore? Of course, we don't, you know, we don't have many magazines in Scotland that could be drafted in. But, you know, where's the rest of political opinion in any of this? And of course, they get to a stage where everyone has got a couple of what we used to call bankers, which is people who can string a sentence together well, tend to hod the line they hod, yeah, are reasonably provocative and interesting. So you just basically book them over and over and over and over again. But this is not OK, you know, it's extraordinary in many respects that Labour has actually managed to get the lead that it's got without being involved in any sort of discussion meaningfully at all, albeit there's all the problems that are getting stored up for them, because they're getting that lead essentially from an unchallenged Tory party, just a Tory party that's really crap, you know, so it can't actually manage to get through its stuff. But again, the same problem that Gordon Brown found, if you can't actually go in for hearts and minds and win the argument about redistribution of wealth, you're stacking that problem up for yourself when you're in charge and you can't make enough change to reach dry land. Same problem that the American Democrats have had, that if you leave the rust belt sitting festering out of the economy, sort of resentful and powerless, but you've promised them something that doesn't eventually get delivered, and you can't deliver what Trump did, which was identity that makes them feel important again, then you've lost everything. You have to have enough real meaningful change happen that makes people think there's a point in getting engaged in politics, there's a point in believing in you, there's a point in the ropey times that are to come ahead, and we get out of this utter rut, which even Tories are identifying, where fundamental stuff has never been dealt with for decades, up to centuries. I mean, it's not just, for example, Scotland that's sitting with big problems about land ownership, for example. It's a problem in England as well that they're also not facing up to. All they're trying to do is deregulate how they're going to do volume house building to create more homes. You'd be very interested to see how that works when, you know, essentially nobody can get a mortgage that they can afford and people are already vastly overcommitted because of all the deregulations that have happened before now. There's fundamental problems that Labour are going to inherit.
Exactly.
And they're not laying the ground here for saying, folks, we need to walk away from this idea that there's easy gains here to be made. You know, you pay for insecurity. You know, we all pay for insecurity. We pay for it in sickness. We pay for it in lack of confidence in the markets. Eventually, if you even want to take that capitalist line, you've got to get to a stage where you're putting a totally different picture out. And of course, at the moment, all the clever people are saying, well, all Keir Starmer has to do is sit, keep his powder dry and just let them tear their legs off. So, you know, there's a lot of grief down the line when that realignment that must happen for British politics, if they're to get anywhere when the next election, you know, there's a lot for them to do.
Well, I mean, Labour, as per usual, it's really are going to be left to pick up the debris. I mean, this is going to be a ruined economy. And it's interesting to note, as you said in your Herald article, that Labour is now in the lead in terms of economics. But it's really paradoxical, because it's the line that's been punted by the Conservatives has been that productivity was awful and wasn't Labour terrible? Well, the Centre for Economic Performance at the London School of Economics concluded that between 1997, remember what happened then, the growth of GDP per capita between 1997 and 2010 was driven by strong growth in productivity, which was second only to the United States of America, and good performance in the jobs market, which was better than the US. So it's that paradox that once you get a reputation for getting up early in the morning, you know, you can be as late as you like, you know, and that's what the Tories have got, a reputation for sound money and sound economic policy. That may have gone now, where they're able to turn around and come out with these utter nonsense and lies. Now, when I've got a lot of questions about the Gordon Brown, Tony Blair era in 1997 Labour, but actually productivity went up and there was growth in the economy and things did get better. You know,
they did. I mean, it's always interesting to me that those kind of comparisons, and of course, I'm not seeing exactly what you've seen, so it could have been a wider one. But, you know, the comparisons against America in many respects are fairly woeful. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that they forgive me for cranking out the Nordics and the rest yes. of Europe and the North Europe. But, you know, most of the countries that are AAA rated are not the United States or the UK. You know, the people who are doing well are small countries of 5 million people who have had better ratings on everything, and not just growth in a sense for the sake of it, but have, you know, less inequality. The States is dragged down by having even more inequality than Britain, which is right up there. I mean, those two, Britain and the United yes. States, are walking hand in hand with, you know, high levels of the underclass in prison. In the case of the States, unbelievable proportions of black men in prison, utter inequality, which, you know, pulls down every aspect of their economy. And that's what we choose to compare ourselves with.
Yes.
Well, hey, if you want to get to the stage of what allows, you know, I mean, these countries, you know, our neighbors are not saying problem free or sort of, you know, unbothered about economic issues, but they've got a solid platform to be working from. And that's what you have to create, because otherwise the pendulum keeps swinging. And the thing is, for them, even with the bad outcomes that the Sweden has at the moment, you know, of losing its social democratic leadership, it did do that already and didn't see a massive destruction of the welfare state. Sweden's mm-hmm. right up there. So even Swedish Tories are brought to the left in the face of a solid, settled will, if you like, of a country. So I would love to see us just leaving the kind of ideas that any form of parity or comparison with the States, yeah, whatever. We need to get back to, you know, the small countries that are doing extremely well. And then other things that flow from that. I mean, I was listening to an interview with the Finland is very much, it's interesting, when I do stuff about Finland, I do get awful pelters online from unionists who kind of, you know, suggest that I should basically disappear off to Finland yes. if I like it that much. Yeah. Lordy, I dare to mention the country twice in 1 month in two different articles. But there's clearly a lot about Finland at the moment, partly because of their NATO application. And because of the fact they are sitting with now, of course, all sorts of, you know, movements across the border because Russian men are trying to get out to avoid the conscription that yeah. Putin has called in. Now, there was an interview with a Finnish minister who was responsible for that. And the level of calmness in that interview was absolutely extraordinary. The interviewer, and I can't remember who it was basically saying, gosh, you know, it must be terrible for you guys, all these, you know, Russian refugee men that are pouring over the border. And the guy said, well, look, you know, they're not really pouring over the border. We've got a couple of thousand, really, our comrade countries. And he listed a whole lot of them that are closer. They have tens of thousands. We just have 1,000 or 2,000. So, you know, he wasn't picking up mm-hmm. the sort of, oh, you know, beat a drum, use it yeah. to make things about immigration. So the interviewer came back in and said, well, you must be worried, though, about, you know, these Russians that are coming over. I mean, you know, they'll want to appeal for, you know, asylum status, and, you know, you'll have problems with refugees. And you could hear the old drum beating in the background, mm-hmm. Rwanda, Rwanda, Rwanda. And the guy basically said, well, if they make the case, of course, if they apply for asylum, we will look at their case. And if they are successful, they will get asylum status, refugee status.
Boom. Yeah.
And then at the end, he just said a small thing. He said, however, just actually being called up for conscription is not in itself a sufficient ground. And because the interviewer was so determined to be pulling the interview onto these familiar British tropes, you know, so that we could start all kind of, you know, agonizing about, oh my God, look at the sort of relatively tiny problem we've got here compared to other people, but still it's us, we're special. Because he didn't manage to get that sort of dynamic going in the interview, he didn't notice that tiny, significant little thing that was said, which is, well, then these guys are going to have to argue other things about persecution should they go back, in addition to simply dodging the draft. Now, you could say that dodging the draft is probably not going to be all that much smiled upon if you go back to Russia, you know, so that once you've got to that stage of crossing the border, you're in a different kettle of fish. But my point simply is, that, you know, this is the kind of rational state that we should be trying to learn from, instead of being fixated by the vagaries of a country that has got its own massively weird dynamics. And I think that follows simply because it is the, you know, well, debatably the world's largest or most powerful democracy. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of our own folk went there, you know.
Yeah.
But actually, where our own folk didn't go, all these North European countries, although many of them did, these places are actually doing better, you know, in every single respect. So I just think it would be great if we could pay some attention to them, Begorra.
Yep, yep, I would 100% agree with that. As we come to just about reach a conclusion here, I'm putting a bet on Liz Truss bingo tomorrow. There'll be plenty of Putin in Ukraine. There'll be the energy package, which is, you know, still going to be double the amount that you would have been paying on average that you would October last year, the energy package, you know, how we did there. And we've got the second lowest debt, GDP to debt ratio in G7. Watch out for those tomorrow, folks, because that's what Liz Truss will be punting ad nauseam. And the energy package is the new vaccine rollout, folks. That's now taken its place.
They may well sort of, somebody, I can't remember who I was listening to this morning, was pointing out that the cost of the energy package will be twice what was spent in COVID. So if that's true, I've no doubt that that will be a just terribly handy way to link the incredible generosity and the scale of the thing and getting us back to the COVID war footing. Unquestioned, Boris did a good job. My God, please let me scream in the corner, stuffy. So, yes, I mean, all of that. But I think she may also have a pop at Scotland, actually, partly because it's popular in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, what she's needing to do, in the same way as the Home Secretary, I can't even remember who it is now, but is going to go in and start punting away about immigration and so on. They're going to have to try and get a few of the old, you know, the old kind of favorite songs going again. Yeah. And one of them, I mean, just look, every time she mentions, you know, sort of, you know, turning her nose up at Nicola Sturgeon or snubbing her, it gets a really warm reaction from whatever room she's in. So my little additional one is, I think she'll take a pop at the Scots.
Yeah, because Kwarteng didn't, which I thought was interesting.
He only had 20 minutes, or what was it? Well, you know, I mean, there's only so many things that you can get wrong in 20 minutes. He just didn't have time, the poor lamb.
Yeah, well, I'm going to say something. One should play the ball and not the man. But I have rarely seen anyone walk more weirdly onto a platform and off a platform in my life. It was a strange, slow. It's almost of having to think, I'm having to think how to walk and get myself on here and get myself off. So
this is truly a terrible thing to say, but I suddenly thought Herman Munster, but that is a terrible thing to say. And it's also, for a lot of people, will mean nothing. But it is a very stiff, he looks like a very tall guy. And he doesn't look like someone who's used to being out and about. And actually, I noticed from some of the gossip sort of stuff that's come through, that there was an event yesterday, I think, after his speech, which was indeed yesterday, wasn't it? Everything's happening so fast.
Yeah.
Where he'd got a whole bunch of, you know, the business leaders and everything gathered in some fringe meeting, and he had come in. The organisers had said to him, you know, you need to say something, Kwasi. And he was very, very reluctant to speak. But they basically said to him, you have to say something. So he shuffled up again, looking very awkward, and just said, basically, you know, cracked a few jokes about the weather, then said business is very important, then came off the platform and left. And the rest of that swally was full of people going, does this guy know how to do this at all? So I don't know, you know, who knows about these people? I don't think either of us are prepared to invest a nanosecond of our lives finding out anymore. But, you know, he doesn't look like he's had to, you know, neither of them look like they've ever had to spend much, well, much time charming people. And I say that and I realize that Fizz with Liz meant that she was actually, you know, the one who was in trying to kind of essentially destabilize her, the worshipful Boris, long before Rishi Sunak had thought about anything. So she does know how to schmooze when she needs to. But Kwasi Kwarteng, no, he doesn't seem to have, mind you, you know, George Osborne, there's a bit of a, I mean, OK, George Osborne could walk. But I mean, you know, when he turned and faced the camera, and those eyes, you know, they just thought, oh God. So let's got let's not get personal.
Let's not get personal. But on a personal note, we went to see a rather charming movie at the weekend called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, which is based on a Paul Gallico novel. For those of you who remember Paul Gallico, he wrote a series called The Adventures of Hiram Holliday, which those of us in the 1960s remember as rather charming television series imported from the States. And it's a lovely story about a cleaning lady in London who goes to Paris to buy a Christian Dior dress, but does manage to bring into play Jean-Paul Sartre, communism and strikes. So it's a lovely, lovely film. Cheered me up no end. Fashions in 1957-58 Dior for women were stunning. So there you go. It's a lovely watch and does have a very strong core to it and a message to it about women and about socialism. So there you go. Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris.
Well, I've got one as well, actually. I went to see Moonage Daydream, which is David Barry film, which was absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's a long film, but the thing about it is it's a piece of art in keeping with the man himself. It's not just, I mean, I'm not meaning that all the other programs have been in any way dull, because if you like David Barry, you can sit and watch Stuff Till the Cows Come Home.
Yes.
But this is very much more, it's a very well-crafted kind of film with lots of footage that, you know, I don't know where they managed to get this all from, but it was following him from the days that his teeth were like something that you could you know, seen in a cemetery. But just the incredible frankness and clarity of him just over all that long period. And then there's just little flickers of himself. It's very cleverly done as a much older man, but just he's occasionally fitted into that to remind the viewer that we know what happened, you know, and we know about his later life. But it leaves you with a tremendous sense of peace, actually, about his outlook in life. And there's one point where he says, very much towards the end, that what his aim is to put the most he can into every day and get the most out of it.
Yeah.
And that straddles, you know, the crazy drug taking days, but, you know, to everything else. And the other thing that's so striking about it is his interest in his own reaction to discomfort. He put himself deliberately and once, you know, into different settings where he didn't know his way around, just to see essentially how he'd react. It was almost like treating himself like a kind of social petri dish, in that instead of trying to constantly find things that were familiar, he was going in very much the opposite direction for a lot of his earlier life. I mean, for sure, obviously, as he got older, he seemed to settle down, and you know, his relationship with Iman is finally mentioned. I mean, one thing that drives me crazy is all these sort of pieces about great male singers who actually had great loves in their lives and children, you know, that nobody even mentions. I mean, the children still aren't mentioned in this, but still, it's an absolutely fascinating film. And you come out feeling really upbeat about everything, and actually, in a way, a lot more sanguine about David Barry himself, that in a way he was already building in the transience of everything to his entire outlook throughout life. And of course, when you get the really bad news that he got, you can't suggest that is something you can easily shrug off and doesn't change your entire outlook. But still, his outlook was ready for that. And it left me feeling a lot more, I know this sounds ridiculous, but happy for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a fan of Bowie that goes right back to the Laughing Gnome days, when he was doing his Anthony and Yuli impressions, right through to the final days. And I did find that the Ziggy Stardust and Aladdin Sane were two albums that got me through the dire straits. That was not an intentional pun. The dire straits of some early 70s pseudo rock. The great man, with his flaws, with his issues. But that's something I really want to see. So, on that note, and with fingers crossed we've got more than 5 years left, and there might be life on Mars, we'll see you next week, chums.
Oh!